Over the course of real time, not centuries spent in cryogenic sleep, in which Annie Rourke Rubenstein had known her husband Paul, she had noticed that some of her father's tastes were beginning to rub off on Paul. While they'd watched a John Wayne Western together, which Annie had almost memorized word for word, the film was one of the tapes her father had at the retreat, and she had watched it dozens of times, Paul cleaned his guns. Since it was difficult to touch anything, either electronic or in book form, when one's hands were covered with oil, unless one wished to ruin the object touched, television, either a video or broadcast programming, was the obvious answer in lieu of conversation. She'd opted for a bath, a luxury she enjoyed and in which she rarely indulged. While sitting in the tub, a facial mask drying, she could hear the film and the occasional comment from Paul as he cleaned not only his guns but hers. Her mind was generally elsewhere. She was about to become the child of a broken home. Her father's and mother's marriage was doomed. If she were inclined to take sides in such a thing, Annie would have been at a total loss as to which side she should take. Living with someone who was as nearly perfect as a human being could be would be frustrating beyond belief or endurance. Yet her mother's inflexibility before the night of the war had been the major contributing factor to the discord which would soon culminate in divorce. Sarah Rourke had refused to even consider her husband's point of view concerning geopolitics. And as he strove to be the embodiment of the philosophical objectivist, the only endeavor in which John Rourke was vastly less than perfect, Sarah Rourke was a liberal. Her father, Annie knew, try as he might, was too soft-hearted, an admittedly odd way of looking at a man who had fought his way across more than six centuries. But instead of realizing that the oil and water of his worldview and his wife's would never mix, he had tortured himself by trying and trying and trying some more. Philosophically, Annie Rubenstein was more aligned to her father, and over the course of time since the night of the war, her mother's liberalism had taken some cruel blows. Sarah Rourke discovered that guns weren't evil, because they were only inanimate objects. Guns could be used for good or ill, and without guns and other weapons available to them, the good people would be the victims of the bad people, having no recourse for self-defense. Sarah Rourke had learned that liberalism in its common interpretation, as opposed to true classic liberalism, of the type which ushered the United States government and other nations of the world into high-priced chaos, was the antithesis of what it truly meant to be human. Altruism, even when it was sincere, was self-destructive. Kindness, Judeo-Christian charity, concern for the welfare of others, all of these were best accomplished by men and women who practiced these undeniable virtues out of the sheer love of practicing them, not out of some warped sense of obligation. To preach weakness and passivity was tantamount to preaching suicide, if not physical, which was sometimes the result at the government level, then certainly intellectual. Her mother had learned, Annie knew, that what her father had believed in all of those years had withstood a philosophical acid test in the aftermath of the night of the war that her philosophy could not. He had been right. She had been wrong. If blame were to be shouldered, but she ascribed blame to neither of them in any real sense, it was Sarah Rourke's. But in a larger sense, Annie's mother's guilt rested only in buying the popular lie as some sort of moral and intellectual superiority, when in fact it was neither moral nor intellectual at all to deny reality and then refuse to realistically try to change reality's nature. The Western was long since over, and Paul had come into the bathroom, washed his hands, and by now was probably reading. Annie got out of the tub and toweled herself dry. She thought about Paul again as she brushed her hair. In this modern age, Paul could have taken a series of injections which would have restored his well-thinned hair completely. He elected not to, self-conscious about the idea. Paul was sweet. He genuinely considered himself totally unattractive. He wasn't, certainly, the sort of man who would be some entertainment idol, but through her admittedly biased eyes, he looked handsome beyond description, with thinning hair or otherwise. As she started to set it down, she dropped the brush.
No! No!
She almost collapsed.
Annie!
Paul was kneeling beside her. Her knees were cold, bare against the tiles of the bathroom floor. Her nightgown billowed out around her.
Annie, what is it, sweetheart?
It wasn't the sort of vision that was really clear, just a feeling. And the visions that were strong feelings were usually the worst kind. She licked her lips, trying to catch her breath.
Oh, it's Dad! Something's wrong.
Can you see where he is?
No. But he's He's sleeping, I think. Paul?
I'm on my way. Lock yourself in after I'm gone. Your guns are on the writing desk.
Paul Rubenstein's guns were in his hands as he ran along the companionway. He should have told Annie to do what? Arouse her father from his sleep? But that might only hasten whatever danger John was in. Call Michael and Natalia, even Emma Shaw? Annie'd probably do that anyway. Shirtless, shoeless, and sockless, Paul Rubenstein was quietly amazed that he'd remembered to pull on a pair of BDU pants. They were buttoned, but his belt was flapping open. He must have looked like a wild man, a pistol in each hand, cocked and locked, half-naked, running. He turned the right angle into the section of companionway along which John's cabin was situated. Elwood Brooks watched Commander Shaw as, at last, she stirred. He carried two gas pistols, improvised here aboard the Paladin, as were the cartridges which they contained. The pistol he had fired at Commander Shaw when she opened her cabin door was loaded with what would generically be called knockout gas, a combination of chemicals which induced instantaneous unconsciousness without causing permanent damage. Not that that mattered, but he needed her alive so she could scream. The second pistol was loaded with cyanide gas. During the Cold War between the superpowers, centuries ago, cyanide gas pistols had been extremely popular as a means of committing murder. This was his intention now. Ideally, according to what Elwood Brooks had read, the subject should be ascending a staircase when the cyanide was fired so that the conditions of a massive coronary occlusion, which the gas simulated, would be further substantiated by the activity of the deceased in the instance prior to death. There was no staircase at hand, but that would be all right. It was doubtful that anyone would believe that Dr. John Thomas Rourke, the living legend that he was, had succumbed from something as mundane as heart failure. But the murder could not be provably linked to an assailant. Brooks's hands were double-gloved, guarding against laser detection of partial fingerprints through ordinary gloves. The gas guns were made from a plastic with a low melting point and would be destroyed. Both guns were loaded now with the cyanide gas in the event that one burst should not be enough to bring down the powerful Dr. Rourke as instantaneously as required. And Brooks had spare cartridges. One of those would be used to kill Commander Shaw. But he needed her awake for now so that Dr. Rourke would come rushing through the connecting doorway between their cabins when she screamed. And she would be screaming in just another few seconds. In order to get a seasoned combat veteran to scream for help, Elwood Brooks had considered various possibilities. There were a few laboratory animals aboard the Paladin. He could have employed the most potentially objectionable of these laboratory animals, of course. Would she have screamed if she awakened with a rat sitting on her face? Probably, but Elwood Brooks disliked rats in the extreme. He elected instead to utilize something with which he was considerably more familiar: acid. He removed the vial of acid from the container in which it was carried under his sweater. The instant Commander Emma Shaw awakened, he would begin to use the acid on her face. She would scream. John Rourke would enter hurriedly. By that time, Elwood Brooks would be waiting beside the door and fire the gas pistol. Then he would kill Commander Shaw and leave. The scream would be heard, but there should be time to escape into the anonymity of the ship's company. Should John Rourke kill him as Rourke went down, so be it. No sacrifice was too great for the cause of National Socialism. Elwood Brooks stood over the bound form of Commander Shaw. He uncorked the acid vial. Her face was very pretty in a real sort of way, nothing artificial about the woman. He would pour the hydrochloric acid onto the left side of her face, at the cheekbone, near her left eye. She would react. Dr. John Rourke would react. Then Dr. John Rourke would cease to exist. Elwood Brooks started ever so slowly to tip the vial. Paul Rubenstein reached John Rourke's cabin door. If someone were inside, about to kill John, knocking on the door might only speed up the process. Paul Rubenstein made his decision. The door swung inward as Paul Rubenstein went through. John, naked, was already rolling out of the bunk where he'd slept, the little Centennial 38 Special in his right hand.
Paul?
It was Annie! She sensed you were in danger.
My God!
Rourke grabbed up one of the twin stainless detonics pistols from the nightstand beside him as his body went into motion. The Centennial was in his other hand. He was moving toward the adjoining door, Paul two steps behind him, John making a wheeling barefoot kick with his left foot. Emma Shaw, trussed up hand and foot with strips of bedsheet, lay on her back in her bunk, smoke rising from the pillow under her head. There was a puff of smoke inches away from John's face. John began collapsing into a heap. It was a blur of motion, the dark shape of a slender man. Paul Rubinstein raised both Browning high powers simultaneously. Paul threw himself right and down over John's body to protect his friend from whatever it was. The carpet beside Paul's right hand smoked. There was broken glass there, and Paul realized what the substance was which had been inside the vial. Acid.
He killed John!
Paul Rubinstein rolled up onto his knees, turning John over onto his back, away from the acid. There was no pulse in John's neck, and his eyes stared up at the overhead light. Paul Rubinstein stumbled back, shook his head, and got to his feet. Throwing the emptied pistol onto the bed beside Amashaw, he reached for the woman with one hand, the bedside telephone with the other. The pillow beside her head smoked, and it looked as if a little of her hair had been touched by the acid. Otherwise, she seemed unharmed.
This is Paul Rubinstein! Full cardiac team to Commander Shaw's cabin on the double! John Rourke may be dead!
He slammed down the receiver, dropped to his knees beside his friend's body, and started CPR. No bra, no panties, no socks. Wearing only a sweater, a pair of fatigue pants, and her track shoes, Emma Shaw hammered her fist against the bulkhead. The pharmacist's mate had cut away about 2 square inches of her hair on the left side and pronounced her whole and well. She'd had split ends there anyway. Meanwhile, the ship's doctor had worked to revive John. Already inside a portable heart-lung machine, he was wheeled out the door and gone. The dead man, a civilian science worker named Elwood Brooks, was body-bagged and taken away on a stretcher. Paul Rubinstein was joined by Natalia and Annie and Michael Rourke, Annie and Michael and Paul following after John to sickbay. Natalia righted the cabin's overturned desk chair and sat down. Wearing a baggy white sweater with the sleeves pushed up past her elbows, a loose-fitting, nearly ankle-length full skirt of navy blue cotton, little white anklet socks and blue ballet flats, Natalia looked lovely, as she always did, despite the hour and the circumstances.
Get dressed, Emma Shaw. You belong in sickbay with your man.
But they...
If you were good enough for John, you'll be good enough for them. I learned that 6 centuries ago. The Rourke family, and that includes Paul, of course, doesn't pull punches. If they didn't like you, you would know about it by now. Resentment about Sarah? There is bound to be that. But Sarah's ultimate goal in life was never to make herself a saint. If that's Sarah alive down there in sickbay, she'll understand. If John had realized years ago what he apparently realizes now, well, I would have killed you if I'd had to. But in a fair fight, of course. Just pull something on and let's go, all right?
All right.
Good.
Emma Shaw pulled something on and went. Natalia sat beside Michael, her head against his shoulder, on the long bench along the bulkhead opposite the doors to sickbay. Annie, wearing a long robe over a long nightgown, fuzzy slippers peeking out beneath its hem, sat on the bench along the opposite bulkhead. Paul, 1 foot resting on the bench, stood beside her. Emma Shaw felt very alone and very responsible. There was no word from the doctors, which evidently meant that John had not been pronounced.
Sarah!
It was Paul Rubinstein's voice which Emma Shaw heard. She turned around, looking back along the corridor formed between the two benches. A uniformed Navy nurse was pushing a wheelchair. In the chair sat a remarkably pretty woman with long auburn hair caught up loosely at the nape of her neck. She was pale, but seemed well somehow. Annie went to her, knelt at her feet, hugged her. Michael bent over her and kissed her. After a moment, Natalia went up to her, said something that Emma couldn't catch, then leaned over and kissed her cheek. Paul crouched beside the chair, put his arms around her, held her for a moment. Then Emma's eyes met Sarah's, and the contact made Emma shiver. This was the woman whose name every schoolchild knew, the woman who had kept her family together throughout all the violence and death in the aftermath of the night of the war, kept it together only to have her husband stolen from her when her back was turned. Emma Shaw licked her lips and found them dry. Annie looked at her and smiled. A man stepped up beside Emma Shaw. When she turned to look at him, she recognized him as Wolfgang Mann.
General.
Commander Shaw. You and I have a great deal in common, it seems. Share a cup of coffee with me. It is only the next room.
Yes.
She felt his hand at her elbow and let him lead her away. Emma Shaw's coffee had no taste.
Emma, you and John are...
Are...
You have doubtless heard the rumors that Sarah and I...
Yes. I'm very happy for you, if it works out. John told me that he thought you and Sarah were in love.
We were. 125 years ago. We never...
I hope you'll be very happy.
I had wished the same for you and John. And you should remember, Fräulein Commander, Emma, you should remember that John Thomas Rourke is an extraordinarily difficult man to kill.
She felt Wolfgang Mann's arm moving to hold her at the shoulders, and she let him.
I know exactly how it is that you feel, Emma. My wife, whom I love deeply, was murdered by the Nazis as a calculated act of terror. I found myself falling in love with Sarah Rourke and thought that she might somehow have some feelings for me. And then she was essentially killed in the fire at the hospital when the Nazis once again perpetrated an act of terror. I had nothing left. My children were dead, my wife murdered, and the woman I loved, but had told myself I could never possess, was also taken from me. The pain inside is impossible to bear, is it not?
Emma Shaw was biting her lower lip and nodded her head, her nose running, her eyes streaming tears, her head aching and body shaking.
I held a brief conversation with the Paladin's chief of security. It was a rather close brush with death that you yourself endured, I understand.
Still unable to swallow or to speak, Emma Shaw managed to nod her head. She didn't care about herself, only John.
The weapon used was a cyanide gas pistol, I believe. Before the night of the war, as I understand it, such a weapon, when properly used, was always fatal. But now we live in an age of medical miracles, Fräulein. You should take heart. If John were dead, you would know by now.
They could still be trying?
To revive him? To what end?
Then her world ended, or at least she thought that it did, because Emma Shaw looked toward the door into the waiting room, and there stood Natalia Temerovna, eyes streaming tears. Michael Rourke sat at the far side of the round table. He had selected a round table, he supposed, because as a boy he had read the stories of King Arthur, who had selected a round table so that no knight would assume himself to be more important than any other. They were not knights at this table, nor would any of them assume themselves more important than the others. But it was a quest of epic proportions upon which they would all soon embark, all of them except Wolfgang Mann, who sat with them as well. He would look after Sarah Rourke while they were gone, for however long that would be.
Go ahead, Michael.
All right. Paul and I figured this out kind of quickly, but we figure it's the only way to save Dad's life. All of us are part of the family.
Emma Shaw looked pointedly at him, and he at her. If he could have read lips, he would have sworn hers silently formed the words.
Thank you.
Our father has suffered irreparable heart damage as a result of the cyanide gas. According to the doctors, the preparation required for the proper adjustment and fitting of an artificial heart would consume a minimum of 72 hours. They can only keep him on the apparatus they're using for another 36 hours without the risk of brain damage. They caught him barely in time as it was, but all their equipment indicates his brain survived intact. A human donor heart could be found, but considering the time constraints, a good tissue match would be unlikely. Meaning, he'd possibly die anyway, and I would give my own heart, but...
Michael spoke with Natalia and offered to give his own heart to save his father's life. Natalia did not agree, but Michael decided to make the offer anyway. She was sensible. Michael was emotional. We all love John in our own ways. Anyway, there is one surefire source for a replacement heart that would be a perfect match in every way, identical to the original. If we can get to that source and make ourselves take it, we can save John's life. Otherwise, John will be dead. I mean, he could be kept alive, but brain damage had set in, and the John Rourke we knew would be dead. Gone. Seems like a clear-cut moral choice, if we got the nerve and can get to the heart. John was certain that Dr. Dietrich Zimmer had cloned us all while we were in cryogenic sleep in New Germany. If John was right, there's at least one duplicate of John Rourke, perhaps several, perhaps dozens, being kept in stasis at Zimmer's headquarters facility, which Allied Intelligence thinks it knows the location of, in the Himalayas. So if we can get in there and back in under 36 hours with the heart, we can save John's life. According to the doctors, he'd be up and around less than a week, Still in time to be of major assistance in the task to come, defeating Dietrich Zimmer's Nazis. Hopefully finding a way to stop the progress of the volcanic vent as it heads towards North American plate. You'd be good as new? With the procedures they have for accelerating the knitting together of bones, they have to cut through the chest and lay the ribcage back in order to operate. But they can make the bones heal together just as they were before. He wouldn't even have a scar. Good as new. Or dead. Those are the two options we have. Now, kidnapping the clone of John Rourke and bringing him back here to murder him won't sit well with any of us. If there was any other choice, I wouldn't touch this with a 10-foot pole. And I don't know if I'll ever sleep the same after this. But I know I'll never sleep at all if I just let John die.
I will do the killing. All of you believe in an immortal soul, and you taught me to believe the same way. But my soul has a great deal more to answer for than any of yours. I will kill the clone.
All of us will do what needs to be done, Natalia. And that's the way it'll be. Emma will do the driving, getting us out of Zimmer's facility with the clone or the heart, whatever. We'll be airdropping in the mountains. Get us all the equipment we could possibly need, sis. Explosives, too. We get in there, we destroy the whole damn thing. Wolf pointed out to Paul and me that there is the possibility that Mom, Sarah, isn't the genuine article, is herself a clone, and that our real mother, the real Sarah, may still be alive inside Zimmer's headquarters in the Himalayas. If she is, we get her out too. Any questions?
There were none.
Be ready to leave in 2 hours. Briefing in 1 hour. Michael and I have discussed this with James Darkwood and the intel people both here and in Hawaii. And there's a plan forming. We haven't ironed out all the kinks. Maybe we won't be able to. We'll see.
What kind of plan?
Well, we can't storm our way in, kidnap a clone of John Rourke, and shoot our way out. That just won't work. So we have a lot we'll have to do in preparation for the actual operation. It's looking like a two-pronged attack on the facility, from within and without. Almost medieval in format. Considering we don't know very much about Zimmer's headquarters in the Himalayas, we don't even know for sure that it's there. Everything's kind of a shot in the dark for now. We should know more by the time we get to the briefing.
Until then, get your gear together. Everything you think you might need. Get ready. After the briefing, it won't be long before we're on our way. The main enemy we have right now is time. We have to fight that harder than anything.
James Darkwood. Annie Rourke Rubenstein couldn't help being reminded of Jason Darkwood, commander of the Reagan more than a century ago, stood at the rostrum at the front of the Paladin's main briefing room. There were a full dozen Navy SEALs in the room as well. Why some locations aboard a naval vessel were called cabins and others rooms bemused and amazed her, but she was used to it. One slept in one's cabin, but inspected maps in the chart room.
In order for the Rourke family to penetrate Dr. Zimmer's headquarters near the pre-war city of Kathmandu in the Himalayas in such a manner that they will be free to operate within the structure for a time period sufficient to allow them to locate the clone they seek, they cannot enter by force. In order to achieve that purpose, we have a number of people online to assist them. Michael Rourke and Mr. Rubenstein will be in full SS field uniform, wearing state-of-the-art makeup in order to disguise their appearance. I'll be with them, since I speak much better German. And in the academy, I always like being in plays. Anyway. In any event, the three of us should be able to walk in with the paperwork being created for us even now. Fly in, actually, as we'll be utilizing one of the helicopter gunships taken ashore a while ago in northern Canada when Zimmer's other base was knocked out. Our faces, Mr. Rubenstein's, Mr. Rourke's, and my own, will match the faces of three of the officers who were killed or captured during that battle. Mr. Rubenstein will fly in the chopper. The rest of the plan is Mr. Rourke's and Mr. Rubenstein's. Gentlemen?
Michael looked at Paul. Paul squeezed Annie's hand and stood, walking up to the rostrum which James Darkwood vacated.
Michael and I don't have all the data we need. Yet. We might not get all the data we need until we learn it on the ground. But the basic plan is this. The three of us, Commander Darkwood, Michael Rourke, and myself, once we're inside, do what we have to do to get away from the intelligence personnel who will want to debrief us after the battle in Canada, which we allegedly survived. We plant the seed that a second gunship should be arriving shortly with wounded and other personnel.
The SEAL team commander, Lieutenant Christakos, raised his hand.
Yes, Lieutenant.
How'd we get there?
Dog-legging it across Canada to Greenland and so on. More importantly, you should be asking how any of us knew where to go. This is a top secret base, known only to the High Command and those personnel actually stationed there.
I'll bet. How'd we learn about it?
From the Allies. We killed an Ally officer, but not before we discovered from him the location of our own base. Can't argue with that, can they?
I guess not.
At any event, when that second gunship arrives, we'll have all the rest of our people inside the headquarters, we hope. The second party will have as its principal task the taking and securing of the airfield facilities. We hope our intelligence people will confirm the headquarters has them. This is a bastardized way of working out the details for an operation like this, but we won't have the final intelligence data until we reach the naval base located about 100 miles inland in what, in our day, was called Bombay, on the western coast of India. These days, it's called Darkwood Naval Air Station, after Commander Darkwood's ancestor, Jason Darkwood. At Darkwood Naval Air Station, we'll get handed to us every scrap of intelligence data concerning the Nazi base in the Himalayas, what used to be Nepal. We already have the two gunships en route to the base by the route that actual survivors from the defeat in Canada would have used, just in case they're picked up off of satellite or high-altitude observation craft. We'll rendezvous with our respective aircraft in the wastelands in what was once Iran. Then, we're into it. Once the second gunship reaches the Nazi headquarters and, with any luck, secures the airfield, Commander Shaw will assign who flies what. All you SEALs have cross-training in fighters, and if you get your tactics straight from Commander Shaw and follow her lead, should be able to handle enough aircraft to get everyone out. Everyone who's able, anyway. Michael and I will get our hands on something that'll blow up and use it to destroy the area where the clones are being kept. Once we rendezvous with the second element, Commander Shaw and Major Tiamarovna will have only one function. Get the clone aboard any aircraft and fly out of there and get back to Paladin as quickly as humanly possible. The other aircraft will be on their own once we're airborne. But we shouldn't have to worry about pursuit. It'd be the job of the second element to sabotage anything left behind that can fly, and generally do as much damage to the Nazi headquarters as possible. After we're out, an as yet undisclosed number of Marine, Airborne, Navy SEAL, and German long-range mountain patrol personnel will attack the base. Even if it weren't desirable to neutralize the base as quickly as possible, there's a substantial chance that Dietrich Zimmer might launch additional nuclear missiles as retaliation for the raid. We can't allow that to happen. Any questions?
They went together as a family, asking her to join them, and she did. Annie cried. Natalia did not, but looked like she wanted to. Sarah stared blankly. Michael held back tears, but it was obvious that he was doing that, holding them back. And Paul, beside him, gritted his teeth, jutted his jaw, and stared with glassy eyes. Wolfgang Mann only stared. Emma Shaw was shocked. John Rourke lay unconscious on a bed behind the glass of the intensive care ward. Tubes led in and out of him, and a temporary artificial heart. It was a machine which pumped his blood and interacted with a fresh oxygen supply, kept him alive. She would do this thing, and if she had to, she'd help Natalia cut the heart out of the clone with her own bare hands, if that was what it would take to bring John back among the living. The man, Elwood Brooks, was otherwise spotless-seeming in his record. He might have been a Nazi, or perhaps just insane. But a little man with a plastic gas pistol had done what armies of enemy commandos of every description had never been able to do. He had killed John Rourke. If the machinery were shut off, John would be dead in a matter of minutes. Only their action, a raid on a facility about which they knew next to nothing, against odds they could not reckon, stood a chance of saving his life, bringing him back from the dead. John Rourke had survived over 6 centuries against every conceivable danger, and a madman brought him down, using Emma Shaw to do it. If Paul Rubinstein hadn't riddled Elwood Brooks's body with bullets, Natalia would have found the man in the brig and killed him herself.
If we're to do this thing, we have to go.
I don't want to lose any of you. If he weren't already dead, he'd tell you that this is madness.
What are you really saying, Sarah?
I know that he tried killing our son, and I know something else.
What, Mama?
That's an academic point now with him dying dead already, isn't it?
What are you saying, Mama?
I loved your father, and he loved me. I don't know what happened to him,
But I do know what he did to me, tried to do to Martin. If I could, I'd tell Dr. Zimmer that all of you are coming, so he could prevent you from getting inside. What you're talking about is murder. Killing that clone is killing a human being. And for what?
For what? For him, for God's sakes, to save our father and your husband. What should we do? Nothing?
John Rourke led a life that will be perceived by everyone as a life dedicated to helping mankind. It should be left at that. With your father dead, Michael, the truth will never have to come out.
The truth? The truth? What the hell is the truth, Sarah? Come on. You know something we don't, you're saying? What?
I know what really happened the night the Nazis attacked the hospital at Eden City. And none of the rest of you do. I know who pointed the gun at my head and pulled the trigger.
What are you saying?
There's no reason to soil your memories of him. Believe me, I wish I didn't remember what happened.
Are you implying that John shot you, Sarah? And if you are, you're saying he did it because of me, aren't you?
Infer what you'd like, Natalia. And I have nothing against you. Maybe John was seized with some temporary madness. I don't know. But he killed the clone of Martin, thinking it was Martin. And if he'd lived, he would have killed Martin eventually or died in the attempt. You know that.
Spell it out, Mom. Spell it out, damn it. Spell it out, Mom!
Fine. I remember your father pointing a gun at my head and pulling the trigger. God help me. The last word I said before I almost died that night was to call out your father's name.
You were shot with a .38 caliber bullet. The X-rays revealed that. That is verifiable fact. Lots of cartridges. .380, like I carry in my PPKS. 9mm Parabellum, like Paul carries in his Brownings. .38 Special, have the same bullet diameter. If enough of the bullet that was lodged in your brain was recovered, a ballistician could tell what kind of gun fired it, not just the diameter of the bullet. It was probably a 9mm Parabellum. That night, John was carrying his Centennial. If the bullet Dietrich Zimmer took out of your head was a .38 Special, then you'd have proof, or at least a basis for argument, Sarah. In those days, the only time John ever carried anything in 9mm was when he used that suppressed Smith & Wesson automatic. And he wasn't wearing that gun that night. If it was a 9mm Parabellum that Dietrich Zimmer took from your head, the person who shot you could have been Zimmer, or one of his people, or perhaps even Commander Dodd or one of his people. Wouldn't that make sense, since the Nazis were generally using guns given to them by Commander Dodd, and the only handguns Dodd had access to were 9mm Berettas, like Michael carries? But we will never know anything more about the bullet, will we? Will we? Because the man who took the bullet from your head was the man who put the bullet there in the first place, and he wouldn't tell you that if he tried making you think it was John, would he?
One thing is clear. Either this woman is one of the clones of Sarah Rourke, or Dietrich Zimmer was able to program her mind with memories that he created for her. In either event, what she says is not the truth.
Damn you, Wolf!
Wolfgang Mann's eyes filled with tears. They flew in separate fighter aircraft as they left the Paladin. The V-Stall tore upward, crashing out of the waves with a loud crack as Emma Shaw leveled out, skimming the whitecaps in order to stay under scanning until well away from the Paladin's actual location. In the co-pilot seat behind her sat Natalia Tyomarovna. Natalia had requested to be her passenger, and Emma was glad for the company. But so far, Natalia had said nothing at all, and it would be a long flight without conversation, radio silence necessary as well. They would bypass Hawaii entirely, already too far north, heading toward the Izu and Bonin trenches and into the Philippine Sea, over what little remained of the Philippines and Indonesia, then around the Horn of the Indian subcontinent. In the first few seconds of going airborne after a submerged takeoff, Emma Shaw had always found it fascinating to watch the action of the slipstream on the water droplets over the canopy. They were gone in seconds, but when circumstances permitted, observing them was like observing living organisms, tiny things in some terrible hurry, condensing, separating, disappearing.
It is beautiful what you see each time you do this.
Why did you ask to come along with me?
Because you and I have been made allies by circumstance, Emma. Had things been different, and I do not regret my love for Michael. But I would have been John Rourke's love, as now you are. I was fortunate, so are you. I loved John, realized they could not have him, then fell in love again with his son. On the other hand, John had matured. That's the only way I can put it. By the time the two of you began to have feelings for one another, he was willing to sacrifice his entire life for a woman who wanted to divorce him. Because to John, the mere consideration of such a thing was out of the question. He's changed, but only a little bit. And you're fortunate that it was just enough. I love Michael now more than I ever loved John then. You and John are meant for each other. Don't believe what you heard. I know John wouldn't do something like she said. Sarah knows that too. The real Sarah.
Then she is the clone.
I did not say that, Emma. The woman we spoke with in sickbay might be a clone or might be Sarah. John felt that she was Sarah. If anyone would know, he would. But if anyone could be tricked, he could be. I tend to believe that she is Sarah.
But
Dietrich Zimmer's success with cloning would be impossible, as John pointed out yesterday, without the ability to somehow record the electromagnetic impulses within the mind in the same way that sound or image is recorded on magnetic tape. If we assume that technology to be wholly viable, then there is no reason to suppose that it could not be utilized for the purest form of what used to be called brainwashing.
I know the term. The Russians used to.
Ancient history. Some of the agencies within the Committee for State Security of the Soviet, as well as some elements within the GRU, that was the Red Army Intelligence, utilized advanced techniques for extracting information. It was very ugly. Rarely was the attempt made to implant information, and in every case I ever heard of, never was such an attempt successful. The point is, Dietrich Zimmer could have fabricated the memories and downloaded the tape with the artificial memories in the same manner he would download memory into the blank mind of one of the clones. Sarah doesn't merely imagine she remembers John trying to kill her. She really remembers it, even though it never happened that way. She has a real memory of the event happening in more or less the way she described, and the implanted memory of John being the man who pulled the trigger. And because the event really took place, only with someone else doing the shooting, she has all the ancillary memory to back up the induced memory. The memory is real, but it is not what really happened. Trying to convince her of that fact would be essentially impossible.
If it is the real Sarah we're talking about.
If this woman is really Sarah Rourke, we may be able to convince her that John never did what she remembers, demonstrating to her the technique by which Zimmer implanted the memories that she has. But even though on a rational level she'll know the truth, her memories will still be there. Zimmer's technique is the most insidious thing I have ever heard of. We could not remove the memory without removing all of her other memories. We are powerless to erase what he has inserted.
Then even if she realizes on a rational basis that John is guiltless, she'll still remember him trying to kill her.
Forever. Yes. When the opportunity presents itself, I hope that I am the one to kill Dietrich Zimmer. But until then, you and I will have to be very strong, Emma. Stronger, perhaps, than you have ever had to be. If Michael or Annie killed the clone of their father in order to save their real father, I have no idea what effect it might have on them. I don't think we can have a doctor remove the heart from one living human being in order to save the life of another, even if the donor is a clone of the recipient. The ethics involved would be staggering. I will kill the donor. And you may have to... What's the term? Damn, yes! The football thing.
The football thing?
Run interference. You may have to run interference for me. The Rourke family tends to moralize quite a bit. Not Annie, really. She's very practical. And Paul would never forgive himself. I will kill the clone just when the operation is about to begin. You may have to help me then. Do you have the nerve for it, Emma? In order to save John's life?
You love him more than you'll admit? Still?
Over the intervening years since I first became entangled with the Rourke family, I've come to believe in the concept that there may very well be someone known as God. If there is, it would only be logical that he doesn't place people into life haphazardly. We all have some purpose. My purpose now can be to save a marvelous life. A life like no other life. And I alone have the ability to do it. To walk over to a sedated body that looks identical in every way to the body of a man I once worshipped. And still do, in a way. And kill. Life on the cosmic scale is very much like life on the most minute scale. There are some people whose mission or lot it is to do the things that other, better people cannot do. I'm one of those people, Emma Shaw. Can I count on you to help me?
Yes. But John may hate us both for this.
Hate us? John cannot hate. It isn't part of his makeup. He doesn't have the capacity for hatred. He might never forgive us, though. Are you willing to risk losing the man you love?
Emma didn't have to think of an answer. It was nearly time for her to begin to climb, get to cruising altitude, and start watching out for enemy aircraft and enemy missiles.
By your silence, I detect an answer in the affirmative.
And we can count on Annie if we need someone else to help us?
Yes.
If his parents could have seen him now, they would have rolled over in their graves. But then Paul Rubinstein recalled bitterly that they had no graves, would have died with all of the rest of the people in Texas with the de facto president of the United States when the sky caught fire during the great conflagration. SS field uniforms were black, and there were collar tabs with the lightning bolt runes of old. The cap insignia was the death's head, just as it had been, but set over the swastika. Paul Rubinstein wore the rank of Sturmbannführer, equivalent to a major, while Michael was a Hauptsturmführer, his rank equivalent to a captain. Appropriately, since James Darkwood was the only one who spoke acceptable German and hence would do most of the talking, Darkwood bore the single starburst of an Obersturmbannführer.
Oh boy, if my mom and dad could see me now.
They'd be proud of what you were doing, Mr. Rubinstein.
Paul smiled, looking at Darkwood in the full-length mirror the three of them shared.
Only if I got a chance to get the words out of my mouth before they started to tear me limb from limb.
I'm finding myself wishing I'd insisted that Maria Leuden had spoken German to me instead of using her English.
Maria Leuden?
A woman I knew very well, before Natalia and I became...
Fortunate we had enough uniforms without bullet holes in them.
Allied Intel has been collecting enemy uniforms since the start, and don't think we haven't used them before.
Paul Rubinstein grabbed up his borrowed Arctic parka and started for the door. Darkwood Naval Air Station controlled the Arabian Sea, the Bay of Bengal, and the Indian Ocean to the west. Smaller than the Naval Air Station itself was Hapgood Naval Base, attached to the Naval Air Station, a facility for servicing submarine craft in the Allied Armada. Although other forces had navies, the United States Navy was the only true naval power, and it ruled the seas. But with the increased technology of the present, even the deepest diving craft was vulnerable to attack from the air. The possession of air power was not a sole prerogative of the United States. As the three men walked toward the briefing area, the temperature a balmy 60 degrees, the wind warm off the Arabian Sea, James Darkwood discussed in layman's terms a sketchy breakdown of force tables as the war was about to begin in earnest.
We had them outgunned, of course, between the United States forces and the forces of New Germany, adding to that the other allies. Most people discount the Australians, for example, but really they have a tough little airborne unit. And although they don't have many aircraft, their pilots are good. If it comes to an all-out land war, we'll win. If it's decided under the sea or in the air, we'll win. The only two really effective weapons in the Nazi Eden Alliance, with the temporary destruction of Eden's chemical and biological weapons facilities, are terror and nuclear.
There's little difference between the two. Nuclear weapons are merely instruments of massive terror, brandished for the purpose of terror.
Oh, you're right there, Michael. But the added factor is that the Nazis have shown us, quite pointedly, that they'll employ nuclear weapons if needed.
During World War II, the reason Hitler didn't have nuclear weapons was that he didn't believe in their potential. Imagine what it would have been like if Hitler's scientists had been able to perfect a V2-type weapon, which could have been launched even from occupied France, to impact the eastern coast of the United States. And the payload had been even the most primitive sort of nuclear device. It would have been vastly smaller than the bombs the United States dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in order to end the war in the Pacific, but such a weapon would have turned the tide of the war. No one in the United States, even at the highest levels of government, would have known the exact capabilities of the weapon system, so no one would have known where Hitler could strike next. The demoralizing effect alone could have won the war for him. If he'd have been able to field 100 such long-range rockets armed with primitive, dirty atomic warheads, he would have won the war. What a world it would have been after that.
We're faced with the same possibility now, really.
Indeed. I remember reading in the history books that after World War II, there were Nazi groups all over, calling themselves various things. In the United States, going under the title of white supremacist extremists and like that. And people didn't really take them all that seriously.
If there had not been a war between the superpowers, if we'd avoided all of that, there would have been a rise in National Socialism again. The population of the United States, because of the baby boom following the war, was aging. By the early decades of the 21st century, it would have been necessary to open the United States to massive immigration from abroad for the simple fact that without it, there wouldn't be a workforce. Half the population over retirement age. That alone would have been all the trigger the Nazis needed to get them rolling with the disenfranchised. It's curious that the Nazis actually needed us.
Us?
Jews. Hitler and his elite needed a scapegoat for Germany's woes following World War I and the onset of the Great Depression. They needed a scapegoat in order to galvanize the emotions and the interests of a country they intended to use for their own purposes. It would have been the same if the night of the war hadn't interrupted it. Nazism is a cancer. But it can't be cut out because it's the formalization of race hatred. And that'll always be there with some people. Today, we have Dietrich Zimmer and his new Reich. Well, let's say we defeat him. Fine. In some future, probably not as distant as we'd hope, there'd be another Dietrich Zimmer and another Nazi movement. It may call itself by another name, or use the old name. But the message of hatred will be the same, and the desire to kill those who are different will be the same, too. We can cut out a Nazi growth, think we destroyed the problem for good. But when we least expect it, the growth will be there again. Infecting everything it touches with death.
Sobering thoughts. And why do we bother, then?
You know perfectly well why we bother to fight, don't you? Decent men and women have two choices when confronted by evil incarnate. Turn your back and await the inevitable, a fight. And mankind has spent thousands of years trying to avoid confrontation with evil. And unsuccessfully, too. We let evil grow to the point where it becomes harder and harder to stop, just hoping against hope that somehow it'll fade away and we won't have to fight it. But always, in the end, we have to take a stand. That's always the way.
Despite the circumstances, Annie Rubinstein was amused. It was odd watching men having their faces made up. The three closest physical matches, bone structure, height, and frame size, were picked from among the officers killed or captured at the Nazi facility in Canada, then their identity papers taken. The theatrical makeup expert who worked on her husband, her brother, and James Darkwood was a veteran of intelligence work. Although her full-time career was in Hawaii, in the movies, she freely admitted as she worked that the occasional jobs for Allied intelligence were both more interesting and more challenging. Tall for a woman, a little past middle age, and exceedingly pretty, with short, wavy, dark hair with just a touch of gray, her name was Helen Gould. Natalia was assisting her, cutting a roll of paper-thin bandage-like material into short strips of approximately 6 inches in length, then rolling each strip. Two containers of water sat on the table beside her. Before Helen Gould began, all three of the men had been told to scrub their faces with soap and water, then rinse as well as possible. After doing so, their faces were blown dry with hair dryers. Helen Gould talked as she worked.
What I'm doing is using some of the same technology that we employ when we're making a life mask of an actor for a stuntman to use when he's performing something really dangerous that the actor can't do himself, but the face has to be seen. The problem here that's different from my movie work is that a life mask that I might make for a stuntman only has to approximate the actor's features when seen quickly and from a distance. Cutaway shots that would show a true close-up on the face are filmed afterwards and inserted at critical points within the action. So when you get the chance to see the actor's face for a real close-up, you're really seeing the actor's face and not the life mask. So that's why I said a moment ago that these occasional jobs I do for Allied Intelligence are a lot more challenging. I have to build up their bone structure subtly, which means I have to do some plaster of Paris work, which means I have to make molds of their faces. If I didn't use the soap, when I remove the plaster of Paris mold, I'd remove the facial hair as well.
Ouch!
As my husband always said, he doesn't have that much hair to begin with. Why are you making a life mask, though, if it wouldn't stand up to close scrutiny?
The man that your husband is supposed to be, for example, has a much lower forehead. And in order to achieve that effect on your husband's face, I have to build up the forehead area. The life mask is a form for me.
Soon you'll all be beautiful.
I think the word you're searching for, Major Tiamarovna, is uncomfortable. Soon we'll all be uncomfortable.
Emma Shaw's eyes squinted through the magnifier as frame by frame she reviewed the video taken by high-altitude observation flights over the now-confirmed site of the Nazi headquarters near what was once Kathmandu. The mountains themselves seemed as innocuous as mountains could be. Visual imagery provided no discernible clue that there was anything here but snow-capped granite crags surrounded by glacial ice and snow yards deep.
Add thermal imaging.
The computer responded, Emma raising her head from the magnifier and staring at the frame she just examined. There were heat signatures everywhere, some of them barely visible, a few of them quite hot. If Dietrich Zimmer's forces were using an airfield, and they had to be because the mountain crosswinds would be dangerous for helicopter use, and the only access into the mountains would have to be by air, the aircraft had to be flying in and out by terrain following. Putting herself mentally into the position of one of these Nazi or Eden pilots, she plotted approach paths to every one of the larger thermal signatures, confirming her gut reaction at last that the largest of these thermal signatures was the access opening into one of the mountains. And she laughed. Zimmer was running an operation very familiar to her, only translated to land, whereas she was used to doing the same thing at sea. The mountain which she now studied in greater detail was like a submerged carrier, like the Paladin which she had just left. And there were access tunnels, the mouths of which opened and closed to admit returning aircraft or allow exit on a sortie. Then, the tunnels were sealed until needed again. She had seen thermal signatures like these before, but of United States submersible carriers. And the signatures showed the takeoff and landing bays. With no clearly present airfield, Paul Rubinstein would have a difficult time, and that would be after fighting what would have to be killer crosswinds in order to reach the right coordinates. If whoever monitored access to the landing bays refused access to the solitary Nazi gunship which Paul would be flying, there would be no place to land, and the whole plan would have to be abandoned. This was a dicey plan, dicey beyond belief, but so reckless an endeavor that it was the sort of thing no security force could plan against. That was the only consolation. As to what was going on inside the mountains, where everything was located, how what she imagined as a series of tunnels could interconnect portions of the complex, she could not hazard a guess from the observation photos beyond the fact that the smaller heat signatures, so faint they were only visible through digitized enhancement, had to be air exchanges. Again, however, she put herself in someone else's shoes. The air exchanges would be located for maximum efficiency. Nazis had but one virtue, if any aspect of a Nazi could be called virtuous. Nazis were efficient in the extreme. The exchanges would be placed near areas of maximal need, power-generating facilities, living areas, the aircraft takeoff and landing bays, etc. She began to study the areas she had defined as the landing bays once again.
Computer, digitally increase pixelization.
Emma was able to make additional educated guesses concerning the landing bays, their size, their structure, their maximum dimensions. Synth fuel fumes were noxious smelling, albeit essentially harmless, and would have to be evacuated before getting into the overall air system of the complex.
Computer, bring thermal signatures to maximum enhancement.
Emma was able to construct rough maps of the takeoff and landing bays, deducing that there were three such installations, all located on the north face of the mountain, designated on the map underlayment as L9. L9 might not be the central section of the complex, but was indeed the business end of the operation. Extrapolating figures based on her familiarity with submersible aircraft carriers, Emma Shaw arrived at a figure for the number of aircraft which the facility might successfully handle. Assuming typical Nazi Eden V-Stall fighters, each landing bay could house and service 120 such aircraft. The three bays, combined, would accommodate 360 fighters. Allowing for squadron size and the like, Emma Shaw determined that roughly 300 V-Stall-type fighter aircraft could be expected to be on hand.
Oh, shit.
She started feeding her drawings into the computer program so that the drawings could be enhanced based upon everything which was known about Nazi Eden airfields. With the help of the computer, fuel storage facilities, tower facilities, even pilot briefing rooms and waiting rooms could be filled in with a reasonable degree of accuracy based upon how such facilities had been laid out in the past. The Nazis were not only efficient and organized, they were also predictable. If an airfield layout worked well for them in the past, it would work again. Eden airfields, of which there were considerably more than Nazi ones, were laid out in the same fashion because the Nazis, of course, were the ones who laid them out for their allies. While the computer crunched her data input, Emma Shaw began working on her escape route from the facility, should they survive long enough to reach that point. The Nazi Eden fighter aircraft were fairly capable machines, but considerably less maneuverable than U.S. Navy fighter aircraft. So she couldn't hang around to get into a fight with any of the 300 or so aircraft which might be on her tail the moment after she took off. She would have to get to maximum speed as quickly as possible and see as her only strategy the possibility of outrunning her pursuers. That was a poor plan, but the best she had. If the sky behind her filled with enemy aircraft or their missiles, she would be done for. And so would John Rourke. On those rare occasions when he indulged in a nap, Dietrich Zimmer left explicit orders that he was not to be disturbed except in the event of an emergency. He knew better than to trust anything truly important to his son, Martin. So when the buzzer beside his bed sounded and Dietrich Zimmer opened his eyes, his first reaction was not anger at being disturbed, but concern at what the emergency might be. He wiggled his toes within his socks, starting his circulation, then slowly moved his feet at the ankles, then began to raise his knees slightly as he spread his arms from his torso and moved them, flexing his fingers as well. This practice consumed only a few seconds, but he somehow felt better for it, more instantly clear-headed when he awakened. The cover on the couch was, like the couch itself, black, as were the walls of the little side room to his office suite. The furnishings were sparse, the only light a single green-shaded lamp beside the couch on a table otherwise devoid of anything except for a carafe of water and a glass. The water was changed every hour on the hour unless he was using the room for sleep. The idea behind its Spartan appearance was total lack of sensual stimulation, thus sleep-inducing. He fluffed his pillow, preparatory to using it again, flung the throw out across the couch so it would not become inordinately wrinkled. He was a neat man, and always had been, and walked to the door. He did not lock it, ever. He searched out the cause of his alarm. It was Rottenführer Hoffmann, his valet. Hoffmann stood at attention just inside the office doorway, about 2 meters away, at the far end of the vaulted chamber.
Yes, Hoffmann, what is it?
Herr Doctor, forgive me for disturbing your rest, but I was told to inform you that a helicopter approaches the Citadel. The occupants, claiming to be survivors of the SS Commando Unit from the headquarters in Canada, they request permission to land.
Who are these persons? Who is their officer?
There are three officers, Herr Doctor. The senior identifies himself as Obersturmbannführer Rudolf Gessler.
Gessler? Oh, there is no Gessler who knows the location of the Citadel.
Forgive me, Herr Doctor, but I was told that the Obersturmbannführer related to Communication Central that the location of the Citadel was learned from a captured American prisoner whom they then killed.
That is plausible, but doubtful. Thank you, Hoffmann. That is all.
Yes, Herr Doctor.
Hoffmann made a neat about face, opened the door nearest to him, and exited the room. Dietrich Zimmer walked toward the desk, stood beside it for a moment, fingers splayed over it, then taking deep breaths as he fully awakened. Three officers in a helicopter approaching the Citadel on the basis of information taken from an American prisoner. Most unlikely. He smiled. It was too stupid a scenario for an intelligence operation. The officers were probably quite genuine. Still, Dietrich Zimmer raised the telephone receiver.
Security? The helicopter in question should be allowed to land, and three officers aboard should have their papers checked. Then, after they have been allowed to refresh themselves, I wish them brought to me. They shall be accompanied by a security detachment wherever they go.
Zimmer hung up the telephone receiver and leaned back, pleased with himself. He raised the receiver again.
Martin Zimmer.
Hello?
You are aware, Martin, that a helicopter with three officers aboard it approaches the Citadel. I have given permission for it to land.
It could be a trick, Father.
Yes, it could. Then we shall see what sort of trick, shall we? Shall we have some fun?
I don't understand.
We have lives to spare, do we not?